5 years. Okay, she said. Where would you start? Navy personnel lists, said Nate. Nope, Alice said, swiveling in her chair. Lunch. They sat on the upper level of the cafeteria. Nate played with a salad, Alice spooned soup. Alice's friend Sophie arrived, huffing from climbing the mezzanine stairs on massive legs. She worked in OSR, where they still counted the rusting radioactive nuke subs, the Oscars and Typhoons and Akulas in Alenia Bay and Poliarni. It still mattered, she said, thin-lipped, never mind what the seventh floor said. She was 50 and had jet black hair, big hair, and black eyebrows, a profile off a Gnosis frieze. She wore black tights and a black billowing dress and black therapeutic shoes with ski-jump toes. A black scrunchie was wrapped around her wrist for emergencies. She set a Sailor Moon lunchbox on the table and unpacked plastic boxes and containers, chopsticks and tasting spoons that stood up on their own, and a cruet of salad dressing. Sophie looked at Nate's salad and poured some of her dressing on top. Try this. Homemade. The dressing had a balsamic sweetness cut with Dijon and a hint of heat, unlike any vinaigrette he'd ever tasted. He said so, and Sophie beamed. Alice told them to stop fooling around and told Sophie what they needed to know, and she ate her curry and reeled it off, eyes closed in the remembering, or in the pleasure of the eating, or both. New London, Connecticut, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Brunswick, Maine. Only 3 bases. Subs were big. Only one place repairs them. They're getting old, being refitted all the time, like the Akulas in the late 1980s. Shukas, they called them, really. A lot quieter, and Alice got her back on track. Electric Boat Works, big shipyard in Groton, Connecticut, across the Thames River from New London. Start there, Sophie told them. Back in Alice's office, the CID link was cathode tube archaic and the names inched down. Security clearance databases, employee roles, U.S. Navy active duty and contractor rosters. Alice's mannish finger ran down the screen. Nope. Nope. Longer than 7 years, less than 3. Nope. Senior management at Electric Boat and General Dynamics, of course not. Alice was fast. She looked at a name, scanned the info, and moved on. She had been pulling at names on lists for 3 decades. They had 2 piles of papers, and Nate stopped arguing about possibilities because Alice was so fast. She had her first string, her lovely 11, she called them, and started going through the holies. Employment, salary, taxes, residence, phone, internet, vehicle, banking, mail, marriage, education, children, arrests, divorces, travel, parents, ethernet or cable, straight or gay. How well did you prepare, our little illegal? How far back did you go? As far as me? Whispered Alice to the screen. 3 days later, Nate and Alice brought Benford the list, and he tapped the end of his pencil on each name as he glanced at the profiles, tap, 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 and tossed the pencil aside and handed Nate the paper. It's Jennifer Santini, Benford said with a yawn, the casual savant with unruly hair. Alice nudged Nate. See, I told you, and cackled. Let's do a deep dive, but I'm sure she's our boy, said Benford. He looked at Nate. Now we go to New London and look around. Sophie's Vinaigrette. Combine pureed garlic, dill weed, dried oregano, dried pepper flakes, Dijon mustard, sugar, salt, pepper, and grated Parmesan cheese with 1 part balsamic vinegar and 3 parts extra virgin Kalamata olive oil and emulsify. Chapter 25. Despite the splendid summer weather, New London was drab and depressed, past its commercial and cultural prime, which had concluded when the whaling fleets disappeared in the 1860s. The once teeming Thames River waterfront, which during World War II had seen gray hulls rafted 3 deep, a forest of masts and antennae and funnels rocking gently on the tide, was now a brackish moonscape of tilting oil-soaked piers and rusted-out warehouses with collapsed roofs. 2- and 3-story clapboard houses, mostly double-family units, covered the residential hills above the river. The black tar paper roofs were separated by the width of 2 outstretched arms, clotheslines stretched between second-floor balconies. Waist-high chain-link fences and swingy gates pitted by the salt air marked tiny front yards and weedy back lots. Across the river in Groton, the electric boat shipyard stretched along miles of the riverbank, a city of cranes, steam plumes, and arching factory roofs. Occasionally visible from the seaward end of a massive floating dry dock, itself the size of a cruise ship, was the impossibly big cigar shape of a matte black nuclear submarine, high and dry on blocks, its 7-bladed propeller shrouded in heavy plastic, hidden from Russian spy satellites. Nate did not know what to expect. They took the train up, Benford did not drive, and they stood on the station platform like 2 Bulgarian swineherds in Sofia for the weekend, not mole hunters looking for a center-trained illegal. It was not clear whether Benford was parsimonious or crazy or simply operationally deluded to insist mystifyingly that they share a turret room at the Queen Elizabeth Inn, a B&B in a creaky Victorian halfway up a leafy hill. And the constant walking, casing, he called it, 5, 6, 12 hours a day during which the quirky, brilliant cockatoo talked to Nate about the OGPU and the NKVD and the Cambridge Five, a primer of Cold War history. Day 1. They worked up and down the hill, uphill in the morning, downhill in the late afternoon, looking at the houses, at the cars parked solid along the curb, the weeds coming up on the sidewalk, and the lace curtains in the front windows. They looked for likely signal sites, cache sites, nearby parks, the geography that could support an illegal. They had nothing. Day 2. They walked past Santini's house at different times to mark the positions of her window shades, to see if the empty geranium pot on the front steps was moved, which could be a safety signal. They were careful at night, walked by the darkened house only once, dim lamplight behind the shade of an upstairs room. Was she sitting in the dark, looking out at the street? Did she have another apartment rented an alias for meetings with her handler? They had nothing. Day 3, they casually asked about her at the faded mom-and-pop store on the corner. No one knew her, no one cared. How the fuck we must look, Nate thought, this counterintelligence mystic and his young sidekick. And he tried a joke, but Benford told him if he didn't pay attention, he'd send him home, and Nate said, pay attention to what? While they were jerking off in new frigging London, Connecticut. They had nothing. They were working on the margins. Benford was determined to keep this out of the gun and badge clutches of the FBI. If she's a center-trained illegal, she'll smell trouble long before anyone drives up to the front of the house. She'll bolt 90 seconds after she sees or hears something she doesn't like. It's their training. They had to do this solo. Day 4. They did it all over again. That night, a summer thunderstorm rocked the trees and moved the shutters on the turret room, and the electricity went out, and a battery radio played downstairs. Nate awoke to a flash of lightning and saw Benford in a chair sitting at the window, staring at the storm, seriously creepy. He was seeing the faces of the 12 Russian agents the CIA lost in 1 year, 1985, the year of the spy, all victims of Ames and Hansen, victims of inexplicable treachery that fed them all to the belching blast furnaces of the Soviet Union. And meals with Benford were the real test, the challenge. It wasn't just the bumper car conversation, but also the lobster bibs and hot sauce and oyster crackers, and rating the clam chowders too creamy, too many potatoes, too brothy, not enough sand, you needed a minute amount of grit, and discussing the difference between cod and scrod and what did and did not belong in a New England boiled dinner. No cloves, ever. There are rules that cannot be violated, said Benford, the mole hunter. With little of substance to go on, Benford on Thursday night over dinner announced that it was time to do an entry into Jennifer Santini's house the next morning. "An entry?" said Nate across the table. They were dining on Bank Street near the harbor. "Benford, what do you mean, an entry?" Benford was sawing at an immense rare piece of prime rib, head turned sideways, the better to slice the flesh. Nate put down his knife and fork. "Compose yourself," said Benford, chewing. "By entry, I mean the extra-legal breaking and entering into the private residence of a presumed innocent American citizen against whom there is no evidence of wrongdoing by two unauthorized officers of the Central Intelligence Agency who are, incidentally, currently engaged in an uncoordinated and thus illegal counter-espionage investigation, which in the domestic field is the purview of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as stipulated by Executive Order 12333. He looked back down at his plate and slathered more creamed horseradish sauce onto his beef. "That's what I mean," he said, then added, "This horseradish sauce is excellent." Day 5. A quiet Friday morning. They waited until 10 and walked bareheaded and with empty hands through the little gate to the back of Santini's two-story house. The windows of the houses across the street were empty. The backyard was unkempt. A rusted washtub lay upside down on the bare earth next to a tilting shack. Benford walked up the wooden steps and tried the back door. It was locked, and he peered through the chintz curtains. No one home. "Can you pick the lock?" asked Nate, standing behind Benford, looking through the curtain. "Be serious," Benford said. He still had an 8-track tape deck at home. "Should we pop the window?" "No, second story," said Benford, who unlaced his shoe, walked over to a rubbery utility cable stapled to the side of the house, and knotted the shoelace around it, leaving a loop hanging free. "Prussic knot," said Benford, and he showed Nate how to stand up in the loop with one foot and slide the friction hitch upward, a foot each time to climb the cable until he could reach the unlocked second-story window. "Where the fuck did he learn that?" thought Nate, as he signaled that he was in. The upper room was an empty, disused bedroom. Nate walked to the door and looked down into the house. He whistled for the dog, but nothing stirred. He imagined a Russian illegal would have a Doberman or Rottweiler silently guarding the house. Nate crept silently down a wooden staircase, the thick mahogany banister creaking as he descended. Tiptoeing through a 1950s-style kitchen that smelled of weed and seeds and oil, Nate unlocked the back door and let Benford in. "The place feels empty," Nate said. He and Benford walked through the downstairs room silently. The feeling of risky trespass enveloped them. The house smelled like a health club. Liniment and dusty radiators, no air moved, incongruous for a bright summer day. The house had two front rooms, dining and living rooms, with windows that looked out onto the street. Chintzy, lacy curtains were drawn across all the windows. Spidery sunlight dappled the threadbare throw rugs laid on dark-stained hardwood floors. The furniture was heavy, dark, overstuffed furry pieces with doilies, actual doilies, on the arms and backs of the chairs and sofa. The mantelpiece above a sooty fireplace was lined with Bakelite mugs and figurines. A sea captain mug, a Spanish girl with a mantilla. One lampshade had a pom-pom fringe around the lower edge. A wrought-iron fireplace poker set stood beside the hearth. Benford's mouth worked as he surveyed the decor. She must have cleaned out half the Portuguese antique shops in Fall River to decorate. Off the living room was a small office with a desk and a low bookcase stuffed with magazines and newspapers. On the desk was a small pile of utility bills and a white and blue porcelain schooner with Ahoy painted on the bow. "Check the desk," said Benford. "I'm going upstairs to look around." Nate registered the ridiculous feeling of not wanting to separate from Benford, but nodded and pulled out the drawers one by one. Empty. As he closed the bottom drawer, he felt resistance and heard the crunch of paper. He pulled the drawer all the way out and saw a rolled-up piece of paper at the end of the recess. He He reached and pulled it out, unrolled it on top of the desk. It was a blueprint, a single sheet, with cross-sectional drawings of parts and electrical connections. The page was labeled Section 37, Fasteners and Brackets. Submarine parts? Santini worked in supply and procurement at Electric Boat. Was this a classified document? Why did she have it at home, stuck at the bottom of a drawer? Benford, meanwhile, had gone upstairs into the bedroom. A four-poster bed was made with a quilt and a floral pattern with three large pillows at the head with lacy pillowcases. The single closet had blouses and slacks hanging uniformly on hangers. Several pairs of shoes on the floor, all sensible and made for walking, were lined up neatly. No pictures, no mementos, no personal items. A house that could be abandoned in 90 seconds. The bathroom was neutral, the medicine cabinet nearly empty. A toothbrush, bottle of aspirin, a twin pack of saline fleet enemas. The pervasive smell of liniment. Returning to the bedroom, Benford pulled out the single drawer of the bedside table. No books, porn, vibrators, or lube. Under a piece of felt, he found a piece of paper with a long list of handwritten dates and times. June 5, 2100. June 10, 2200. June 30, 2130. Transmission schedule. She probably carried the laptop and encryption card with her. Standard meeting sched with a handler from the Russian consulate in New York. A penetration of the submarine program. Benford closed the drawer and started downstairs to tell Nate. Nate had just finished checking the backs of the other drawers again, but found nothing. He rolled up the blueprint to take upstairs to show Benford. Walking out the door, he stopped. Jennifer Santini was standing in the living room looking at him. A duffel bag was on the floor at her feet. Nate realized that they had never actually seen her before. Huh. She works out. With weights. On steroids. She apparently had just gotten home from the gym. Why wasn't she at work? Jennifer was in her late 30s of average height. She was dressed in skin-tight spandex shorts stretched by tree-trunk legs, calves and quadriceps bulging. Her arms, shoulders, and neck were corded with muscle, her jawline bulged. She wore a tight tank top that covered not feminine breasts but dinner plate-sized pectorals with nipples. She had brilliant green eyes, the whites bluish with health and vitality. Her face was etched around her mouth and a sharp, straight nose. Her forehead was deeply creased by the frown splashed across her face. She wore her red hair slicked tight to her head, pulled back in a ponytail, a bullet, a torpedo, an assembled action figure, a crossover SUV with the parts cobbled together. In that final instant of appraisal, Nate noticed that she had beautiful feminine hands, with manicured nails painted a light pink. She was barefoot, and her feet likewise were pretty and delicate, with painted toenails in the same soft color. The sound of Benford clumping down the stairs triggered Jennifer to move, blindingly fast toward Nate. With hideous power, she swatted a lamp off a side table at him as she closed the distance in two long strides. Nate ducked the lamp, which smashed against the wall behind him, but straightened to find himself face to face with her. A rock-hard forearm against his throat, pushing him back against the living room wall, while taking thunderous sweeping clouts at him with her free arm. Nate put both hands on her forearm and pulled. Nothing. Nate hammered on her arm, but she stayed with him, crushing against his throat with those Schwarzenegger arms and Grace Kelly hands. Nate threw an overhand punch at her face, his fist glancing off her cheek with no apparent effect. Her face was inches from his, and she bared her teeth with the effort. Nate expected her to bite his lips off. As she continued hitting him with looping punches, insane, disjointed thoughts ran through Nate's mind. One, his luck he has to corner the one Russian illegal in the world who isn't the bird-watching accountant. Two, what in Christ the men in her office must think about her as she sits at her desk every morning. And three, what, if anything, does this cyborg do for sex? Then, absurdly, Nate thought about what Dominika was doing at this very moment. Where was she? An inexpressible sadness swept over him as he thought that Dominica might be dead. And his head bounced off the wall and his throat constricted, and he thought that this freak was part of the machine that killed her. Benford appeared at the bottom of the stairs and stood in shocked immobility. Jennifer looked for a second at the tubby, rumpled man. He would be dessert after the main course, and Nate raked her shin with his shoe and stomped on one pretty Lolita pink foot, which made Jennifer ease up an inch, and Nate slid sideways away from her pinioning arm and kicked the spandex bulge between her legs with his instep as hard as he could. Jennifer grunted like a man, held herself with both hands and thumped heavily on the floor, then fell over on her side, doubled up. Benford looked at Nate, then back at the beast on the floor. Nothing in his 30 years of mole hunting, spy catching, illegals baiting was ever like this. Especially not when Jennifer suddenly sat straight back up like an unstoppable serial killer at a lakeside summer camp. She picked up the glass and wood-topped coffee table in front of the couch and threw it across the room at Benford, standing on the bottom step of the staircase. Benford called upon some hidden burst of speed, perhaps held in reserve from his 2 years as equipment manager of the Princeton Varsity Heavy Eights in the late 1960s, and pounded back up the stairs just as the coffee table hit the very spot on which he had been standing, smashing wood and glass and knocking out two sturdy balusters. Benford did not stop moving up the stairs and disappeared above the second floor landing. Jennifer turned back to Nate, who now stood in the middle of the living room. In the last seconds, he moved a few steps and had taken the iron poker from its stand near the fireplace and was holding it by his side. Her ponytail swinging, Jennifer rushed at Nate again, her bare feet lightly slapping the wooden floor. Nate bizarrely remembered his hand-to-hand instructor's name was Carl, took a half-step forward, snapped his wrist and hit Jennifer on the side of the neck with the poker, like in close-quarters training, the brachial plexus. The shock of the impact ran up Nate's arm. It was like hitting the trunk of a holm oak. A surprisingly feminine shriek came out of Jennifer as she was catapulted sideways into the couch, which overturned backward, doilies flying. She rolled 3 feet along the floor until she came to rest against the far wall, her face against the baseboard. Breathing hard, his arm tingling and numb, Nate held on to the poker, rounded the corner of the overturned couch, and knelt beside her. One of her legs twitched slightly, and the simian muscles in her bottom fluttered. Nate pulled her over to flop her on her back. One of Jennifer's eyes was open, sightless. The other, mismatched, was rolled up into the back of her head. Her mouth was open, but Nate could detect no breathing. Those fucking pink nails against the dark wood floor. One of Jennifer's pedicured feet lay on top of a doily like an eclair in a display case. The stairs creaked and Benford came up to stand beside Nate. The living room was devastated. Broken furniture and ceramics littered the floor. Benford looked down at Jennifer's lopsided face.
"Jesus," he said.
"She's like a fucking Bond villain," said Nate. "Where do they find these people? I think I bent the poker." He reached down to feel for a pulse on her neck, but her head flopped over to the other side too loose, too wobbly.
"Don't bother," said Benford. "The cervical neck flexor is gone. The strike tore the spinal cord loose. Avulsion."
"What the fuck are you talking about?" said Nate, whose hands were starting to shake.
"Avulsion. You separated her neck." Nate wiped his face.
"Terrific. Stop me before I kill again."
"Are you okay?" asked Benford.
"Yeah, thanks for the backup. The diversion of you running up the stairs gave me the opening I needed." Nate stood up and let the poker drop to the floor. "Now what do we do?"
"I found a transmit skid," said Benford. "We have to find her laptop and encryption card. Look in her bag. She probably communicated via secure internet link. That and personal meetings.
You?"
"Some sort of parts blueprint in a desk drawer. We should take this place apart." "Fuck that," said Benford. "Collect what we have. We can call the FBI in now. Let them search this place with tweezers and baggies. They can go right ahead and explain how they didn't catch an illegal operating right in their backyard. They can stuff their primacy up their asses. Benford's Creamed Horseradish Sauce. Cook a medium bechamel. Incorporate butter, Dijon mustard, and grated fresh horseradish to taste. Season with ground black pepper and red wine vinegar. Chill and serve. Chapter 26. The Moscow summer was coming. The sun actually felt warm on her face. Dominika had started work on the special project in the Americas department under General Korchnoi. Soon after her transfer, the general took her aside and told her they, the general and Dominika, would be taking an operational trip. The general said they were bidden to the first deputy director's office within the hour to discuss it. Dominika knew she was deceiving General Korchnoi, using the operation as cover to travel overseas so she could recontact the Americans. She liked and respected the general. He was professional and helpful, and she reflected that she was now taking advantage of someone decent, just as she had been taken advantage of by others. The muck of the cesspool had begun to stick on her haunches, too. There was nothing to do about it, she told herself. She would have to betray his trust. Back upstairs to Uncle Vanya. She would look him in the face and enjoy it. Her secret had not been discovered by the interrogators at Lefortovo. Dominika Igorova was a CIA penetration of the SVR, and none of them knew it. She had manipulated Uncle Vanya to put her back on the case against Nate. Now she would report early success, arrange more contacts, more foreign travel. The clandestine agent reactivated. What was this fever in her body? The Americans understood her. They had recognized right away the Zazdat, her thirst for owning this secret, for the power it gave her. Nate's purple cloud and Bratok's purple cloud and Forsyth's azure halo, all intense and precious. They knew her better than her own countrymen did. She did not know what exactly were her feelings for Nate. Thoughts of him while she was in prison had helped her survive the cabinets at the ends of the prison corridors. She tried not to think about their one night together, and she wondered if he thought about her. He had treated her mostly as an asset, a commodity. Did he ever see her as a woman? Did he care for her, Dominika? She had to see them, all of them, the Americans, but especially Nate. Sending a message to them from Moscow would have been a frightful risk. Directorate K almost certainly would be watching her periodically, checking. They always did with the rehabilitated. With overseas travel imminent, she could wait. It was time to go upstairs. They rode the elevator together in silence. She liked the white-haired spy beside her. The small space was filled with his deep purple spirit, comforting and steady. She knew that beneath the paternal smile was operational brilliance, a keen intellect, unbending patriotism. How had such a decent, thinking man lasted this long in the service? From where did he draw sustenance? Dominika had no illusions that this old professional wouldn't be able to detect any misstep on her part. She would have to be careful around him. They walked together down the carpeted hallway Dominika knew so well, past the gallery lined with the airbrushed portraits of the directors. The gray cardinals stared at her as she passed. "You escaped this time," they seemed to be saying to her. "We'll be watching." They called as she walked past them, their eyes following her. Korchnoi studied her face as they arrived at the executive suite and opened the door. He had seen the emotion in her, could feel her bristling. "How to harness this?" he thought. They entered the office and Vanya was waiting for them, bluff and bald and backlighted canary yellow, his ugly, ambitious color, against the windows, a hearty clap on the shoulder for Korchnoi, a sugary welcome for his niece. Dominika knew that the more sugar he spooned out, the more vinegar would fill her mouth. Now down to business. The target was still the American, the CIA officer called Nash, who held the name of the traitor in his head. Dominika must succeed, for time was of the essence. The general and Dominica would have been surprised that their silent thoughts were very nearly identical. Vastine. Boaster, bouncer, blowhard. General Korchnoi spoke quietly, thoughtfully. This project will require Corporal Igorova to make periodic foreign trips. Is there a problem with that, considering her recent and highly lamentable investigation? Uncle Vanya spread his arms as if in benediction. No, of course not. Everything to be left in your capable hands. Getting to the American. Recontact is the point. See to it, then, and let it be done excellently. Vanya winked at her. They were walking back along the broad corridor of the ground floor, Korchnoi speaking easily, making lists for her, directing her to begin filling the folder with details, schedules, gambits. Dominica saw that he was pleased and gratified, and not at all suspicious or worried. Why should he be? Dominica was an excellent protege. Betraying him was difficult, but it was necessary. That was how it had to be. Coming toward them in the corridor along the opposite wall was Line F executioner Sergei Matarin. He seemed not to recognize her. Dominica's vision started to narrow. She felt fear, then an aerosolized rage that had her measuring the distance between her fingers and his eyes. Could the general sense the woolpack of her hatred? Did he not see the trail of bloody footprints, or the black shroud that billowed around Matarin? Could he not hear the musical note of the chine of his scythe as he dragged it behind him? Matarine's milky white eye passed over her as he continued down the corridor. As he walked, he hugged the wall like a ray swimming over a sandy ocean floor, trailing thick, elemental black smoke, like blood in the water. Looking after him, Dominica shuddered at the thinning hair on the back of his skull, and at his empty fingers that grasped and ungrasped, waiting to hold a knife. 8 o'clock and a rainy night. Vanya Igorov was driven through the Borovitskaya gate in the western corner of the Kremlin, tires drumming over the slick cobblestones, past the Grand Palace and the Cathedral of the Archangel, and left past Building 14 to a yawning, deserted Ivanovskaya Square. His official Mercedes eased through the narrow gate to the inner courtyard of the mustard-yellow Senate building and pulled to a stop under a dimly lit porte-cochere. The last time he had been inside these walls was to receive his second star. Tonight, he had to show he deserved to keep it. An aide knocked once, opened the door, and stepped aside. The president's office was relatively small and richly paneled. A green marble pen set was the only object on the surface of his desk. The lights in the wall sconces were dialed low. The president was in a dark suit and white shirt with no tie. Igorov tried not to notice that Putin was in his stocking feet, his shoes pushed underneath his chair. The president was sitting at a small inlaid table in front of his desk, his hands folded in his lap. No papers, no news wires, no television. Igorov sat down at the little table. "Good evening, Mr. President," he said. Putin's face, as usual, was a mask, but tonight he looked tired. "General Igorov," said Putin, who looked at his wristwatch, then fixed his electric eyes on Vanya's face. "Go and keep it brief." Igorov modulated his voice. "The communications manual acquired from the Americans continues to be a rich source of critical data and cyber opportunities in the future." Putin nodded once, blue eyes unblinking. "Our sensitive asset in Washington, SWAN, is providing comprehensive technical information on U.S. military space vehicles. The Kosmicheskaya Voyska, the space forces, rate the intelligence as excellent. My resident in Washington..." "You mean my resident," said Putin. "Of course, your resident. General Golov is handling SWAN with utmost care," said Igorov, telling himself to watch it with him in this mood. An aide knocked and brought in a tray with steaming tea and delicate filigree podstakaniki, silver spoons balanced over the rims of the glasses, a sugar cube in each. The tray was placed on a nearby conference table in the corner of the room, along with a silver salver of Madeline's. Both were out of reach and remained untouched. "Go on," said Putin after the aide had left. "We continue to search for a mole run by the CIA, probably in the service. It is only a matter of time before we unmask him." "It is important that you do so," said Putin. "More evidence that foreigners, the Americans, are working to disrupt our government." "Yes, Mr. President, it's doubly important. The mole threatens the security of our assets." "Like Swan," said Putin. "Nothing must happen to her. No kompromatirovat. No international flaps, no failures." Igorov noted with interest that the president correctly knew the gender of Swan. He knew he hadn't mentioned it before. "We have identified the CIA officer who handles this mole. I am initiating an operation against him to obtain the name of his agent." "Fascinating," said Putin, a former KGB officer. "But you do not need my approval to conduct such an operation." "It is a complicated conspiratia," said Igorov, circling around the subject. "I intend to direct one of our officers to engage the American to compromise him. I want the name of his agent." Putin's mask shifted slightly, whether from discomfort or vicarious pleasure Igorov could not tell. "I want discretion and moderation. I do not condone the physical abduction of this CIA officer. This is not done between rival services. The consequences would be unmanageable." The president's voice was silky, the cobra flaring its hood. A porcelain Fabergé clock on a side table tinged the half hour. The tea across the room had grown cold. "Of course, I am taking all precautions, Mr. President. Apart from my direction, a senior officer is supervising the action in the field against the American. And the young officer, a woman, correct? Was recently cleared in a counterintelligence investigation?" "Yes, sir," said Igorov, looking at the liverwurst lips as they moved. "And do I remember correctly that this young woman is your niece?" He looked Igorov in the eyes. "The daughter of your late brother?" "Family is the best security," said Igorov lamely. This was a show of omniscience, of strength, designed to shock, then awe subordinates, like Stalin used to do. "She will follow my directions. Have her engage the American, but I do not condone active measures. It is out of the question." Putin obviously knew the option had been discussed. "As you wish, Mr. President," said Igorov. 9 minutes later, Igorov's footsteps were ringing down the grand staircase as he scurried to his waiting car. He collapsed in the back seat, contemplating the disasters that lurked in the career of ambition. As his Mercedes flashed under the Borovitskaya archway, Vanya did not see another official car, less grand, heading toward the Senate building he had just left, carrying his Lion KR counterintelligence chief, the diminutive Alexei Zhuganov. Kremlin Madeleines. Make a Genoise batter by mixing eggs and salt until thick, then add sugar gradually and vanilla extract. Fold in flour and beurre noisette to form a thick batter. Pour into greased and floured madeleine molds and bake in moderate oven until edges are golden brown. Unmold and cool on a wire rack. Chapter 27. United States Senator Stephanie Boucher, Democrat, California, was not accustomed to driving or parking her own car, or to walking down a corridor unescorted, or even to opening her own doors. As vice chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, she had a phalanx of interns and staffers to carry her in a sedan chair if she wished. She could have used some help right now. The front bumper of her car kissed the bumper of the car ahead of her with a quiet crunch. This motherfucking parallel parking. Senator Boucher twisted the wheel and touched the gas. Her rear wheels hit the curb, the front of her car still sticking out into the street. Boucher banged the steering wheel with the heel of her hand. She eased forward to get a new angle. The car behind her honked. Take the spot or move on. Senator Boucher rolled down the passenger side window and screamed, "Fuck you!" at the other car as it squeezed by. Boucher knew she should be more discreet. She was a known face, a celebrity even, on the Hill. But that cocksucker was not going to honk at her and get away with it. On the fourth try, Boucher managed to ease into the space. It was early evening on a dark and leafy N Street in Washington, D.C. As she locked the car, she saw that her left rear tire was up on the curb. But the hell with it. She turned and walked along the sidewalk past the elegant brownstones, their Georgian doorways lit by beveled glass lanterns. Boucher was 40 years old, short and thin, with a boyish figure, her legs toned and slim. Piercing green eyes and a button nose were set off by shoulder-length blonde hair. Her mouth was her only feature that was not consistent with the image of vibrating energy and corporate power. It was small and frowny and thin-lipped and pinched, a mouth that would as soon bite down as pucker up. Boucher was ascending the power chain on the Hill. Young to be a senator, but she knew she had earned her position on the Select Committee on Intelligence with fierce preparation and hard work. She sat on other committees as well, but none were as prestigious as SSCI. 12 years ago, she had been elected to Congress after a hard-scrabble campaign in a Southern California district replete with defense and aerospace contractors. She became adept at appropriations and at holding the bag of money over people's heads to get what she wanted. Ascending to senator had been the next logical step, and now, in her second term as newly named vice chair, she had a hand in legislation, appropriations, and oversight within the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, and the intelligence community. Abrasive, impatient, and abusive during committee hearings, she tolerated defense for the commerce it brought to her home state. She recognized the political unassailability of DHS, which she privately thought was a collection of third stringers operating in a world they scarcely understood, trying to do brain surgery while wearing catcher's mitts. But it was for the Intelligence Committee, the conglomerate of 16 separate agencies, that Boucher reserved her most bitter, thin-lipped excoriation. Defense intelligence organs, DIA and DH, did not concern her. They were career soldiers thrashing over their heads in the foreign intelligence milieu when all they really wanted was a clear photo of the next bridge beyond the next hill. The Department of State's INR had some brilliant analysts, but state rarely collected secrets anymore. Their analysts needed to get out in the sun more, get some vitamin D. The FBI were the reluctant brides, forced into a domestic intelligence role they neither understood nor welcomed, inevitably reverting to their button-down cop roots, preferring to run stings on Arab teenagers in Detroit rather than build networks of long-term sources. But these were just the crowd. Senator Boucher really had the wood for just one agency, the CIA. She loathed the intelligence officials who sat before her in the committee room, slouched in their chairs, at turns earnest and evasive. Boucher knew they were lying to her every time they spoke, confident, slick, smiling, and knowing. She knew the briefing papers they carried in their zippered security bags were so much wallpaper, concealing the real story. The hard-working men and women of intelligence, they'd say. The National Clandestine Service, they'd puff. The gold standard of intelligence collection, they'd announce. These were the familiar phrases that drove Boucher up the wall. It was during her first term as a freshman congresswoman that Boucher had met 75-year-old Malcolm Algernon Phillips, an on-again, off-again lobbyist, lavish party-giver, and behind-the-scenes power broker in Washington. Phillips knew everyone in town and, more important, knew, in Washington parlance, who was spanking whom, with what, and why. His many admirers would have been scandalized to learn that the silver-haired, impeccably dressed Phillips had since the mid-1960s been a talent spotter for the KGB, recruited as a young socialite when Khrushchev was still premier. Though the Russians paid him well, Phillips was in it for the sheer joy of gossip, repeating secrets, breaking confidences, and wielding the power that came along with it. He cared not a whit about what the Russians did with his information. The Russians, in turn, displayed an uncharacteristic patience with Phillips. They did not push him to elicit secrets or pay bribes or filch documents. They were content to let him spot candidates for recruitment from within the maelstrom of official Washington. He had been doing it for nearly 40 years, and he was very good at it. During a winter dinner party at his Georgetown home, Phillips' finely tuned antennae detected the junior congresswoman from California something in addition to the usual Capitol Hill cocktail of ambition, ego, and greed. A private lunch with Boucher 6 weeks later confirmed his suspicions. Phillips told his KGB handler that he might have found the perfect engine for their needs. Stephanie Boucher was, Phillips assessed, utterly devoid of a sentient conscience. Notions of right or wrong did not occupy her thoughts. Neither did patriotism nor loyalty to God or family or country. She was concerned only about herself. If it suited her, Phillips reported, Stephanie Boucher would not think twice about the morality of spying for Russia. She grew up in the South Bay, in Hermosa Beach, every day wearing cutoffs and surfing and smoking and fending off the smooth golden boys. Her father was pathetic, letting her mother whore around. She grew to despise her parents. Then her father surprised them both. She was 18 when her father shot her mother, at the time in the arms of a FedEx delivery man. Stephanie broke down for a while, but she rallied and made it shamefacedly through the University of Southern California, then graduate school, then drifted into local politics with a growing conviction that friendship was overrated and that relationships were worth it only if they could be exploited for personal advancement. Some of her mother's DNA stuck, however, and along with serial misanthropy, Stephanie progressively discovered she liked sex. A lot. The kind with no commitment. She had to control herself as her political career blossomed, but it was always there, right beneath the surface. The residentur in Washington did careful research on their recruitment target. A picture slowly came together, and everything the SVR saw and heard was consistent with what Malcolm Phillips had reported. A recruitment operation was initiated, and a progression of SVR officers and influence agents continued to vet the senator. But it was not until Washington resident Anatoly Golov, urbane, soft-spoken, and charmingly ironic, made contact that Boucher got a first peek behind the treasure room door. The stock philosophical blandishments of recruitment made little impression on the young woman's mind. She was not interested in the concept of amity between nations, nor in the desirability of a world balance between modern Russia and the United States. Golov could see all this and did not waste time. He knew what she wanted: a career, influence, power. Golov commissioned a series of thoughtful global backgrounders drafted by Service One, which he then shared with the senator for discussion. International relations, the global politics of oil and natural gas, developments in South Asia, Iran, and China. These specially prepared briefs on intelligence, economics, and military matters quickly made the senator an expert on her committee. The chairman, impressed by her fluency and scholarship, offered her the vice chair of SSCI. It was not lost on the senator that bigger things were possible. As the relationship developed, Boucher never remotely struggled with the notion of espionage. She discussed SSCI hearings and issues during dinners with Golov, a matter of give and take, natural for a Washington politician. Golov elicited the information from her as if he were deveining a shrimp. The increasingly frequent payments from him for expenses, Stephanie considered her due. Boucher had long since passed the point of no return, but it was not necessary to remind her of it. In her mind, she was building her advantage, preparing herself for advancement, working toward her goal. The SVR had a member of Congress as an active source. Swan. Anatoly Golov waited for Senator Boucher in the small garden dining room at the rear of the Tabard Inn on N Street. Tiny lights were threaded through the branches of potted trees in the narrow garden closed off by a tall brick wall. Traffic noise from nearby Scott Circle could have been the murmur of gentle nighttime surf. Golov had been Washington resident for a year, was personally handling Swan. He had vast prior experience in operations and recognized that Swan could conceivably be the most valuable American source Russia had ever run. Even so, he disliked the agent and he disliked the case. In truth, Swan scared him a little. He thought back to the early days when agents were recruited because of their ideology, their belief in world communism, their commitment to the dream of a perfect socialist state. Now it's all charada, a charade, thought Golov. Swan was a greedy, uncontrolled sociopath. He shot the cuffs of his shirt. Golov was imperially tall, his thinning gray hair combed straight back. A long, straight nose and delicate jaw hinted at Romanov, but that didn't matter anymore, not even in the SVR. Golov was dressed in a sublime two-button dark Brioni suit, with a razor-starched white shirt and silk navy tie from Marinella with tiny scarlet dots. He wore black Todd Gamino loafers over charcoal gray socks. Perhaps he was an elegant European count, perhaps on vacation in the United States. The only jarring note was the plain gold signet ring worn on his little finger. On Golov it was mysterious, hinted at hidden history. Golov was finishing his dinner of an egg-lemon-lamb fricassee, red kale sautéed in balsamic vinegar and pomme de terre éligot as good as he remembered having in southern France. Though he normally did not drink when operational, he needed to fortify, or did he mean numb, himself when meeting the senator. He finished his second glass of Chardonnay and ordered a doppio espresso. While the table was cleared, Golov reminded himself once again that Swan was too important an asset to waste time and technique on trying to mollify or discipline or control. What Stephanie wanted, the SVR would give her. She had been passing minutes of SSCI closed sessions, hundreds of digital pages of testimony by defense and intelligence officials on weapon systems, intelligence operations, and U.S. policy the likes of which the center had never seen, never knew existed. In return, the SVR had settled on salary payments in amounts unheard of in the annals of the chronically parsimonious Russian intelligence service. Her value elevated her above the status of agent. She was a super mole, a potential agent of influence, a Manchurian candidate. Golov had begun directing, assisting, coaching her, preparing her further for important career advancement. It was not new. Over the years, the Russians had done it before. Obliquely for other members of the U.S. Congress. Unfortunately, most of those debauched legislators eventually drove into lampposts or caught air before splashing into the reflecting pool or skidded off bridges into tidal estuaries. Compared with those serotic bumblers, Swan had no such vulnerabilities. Better yet, none of them had had the potential of Swan. The center envisioned Boucher as a cabinet member, a director of the CIA, perhaps even as vice president. Her production was astounding, and the best was yet to come. Swan was on the threshold of tapping into the most sensitive current SAP in the Pentagon, the Special Access Program devoted to the development of an advanced global orbiting vehicle, GLOVE. Initial intelligence already provided by Swan astounded the Russians. GLOVE would be a hybrid platform capable of collecting SIGINT and LINT while providing GPS support. It could protect itself in orbit from killer satellites. More alarming for Moscow was GLOVE's anticipated ability to launch weapons from space against targets on Earth. Directly. No warplanes, no refueling, no radar, no stealth technology, no anti-aircraft missiles. No lost pilots, no warning. Pinpoint strikes on the surface of the planet from 300 miles in space. U.S. Air Force project briefers had called it the finger of God. The billion-dollar SAP was contracted exclusively to, and managed in a strict compartment by, Pathfinder Satellite Corporation of Los Angeles, located in the high-tech corridor along Airport Road in the LAAFB in El Segundo. This coincidentally also happened to be Senator Boucher's former congressional district. Yes, indeed, thought Golov. The best is yet to come. Senator Boucher walked briskly through the small English country house lobby of the Tabard Inn, squeezed past people in the narrow picture-lined corridor connecting sitting rooms and lounge, before coming out to the garden. She saw Golov at a table in the rear and strode over to him. Golov stood up, offered his hand, and bent in the European fashion to bring the lips to within inches of the hand. Golov did not actually touch the senator's hand with his lips. He recalled early assessment reports about her social habits and what she liked to do with those hands. "Stephanie, good evening," said Golov, choosing his words. He used her first name to create familiarity and to avoid using her title, striking a chord between courtesy and intimacy. You never knew what kind of mood she would be in. Golov waited for her reply as she sat down. "Hi, Anatoly," said Boucher. She put her elbows on the table. "I'm sorry to get right to business, but did you receive an answer from your people?" The senator fished a cigarette out of her purse. Golov leaned forward to light it with a pencil-thin gold Bugatti lighter. "I passed along your request, Stephanie," said Golov, "along with my recommendation that they should agree without hesitation. I expect a reply within the next few days." He sat with his hands resting easily on the tablecloth. His coffee arrived, and Stephanie ordered a whiskey and soda. "I feel so good that you recommended they pay, Anatoly," said Boucher in her committee voice. "I don't know what I'd do without your support." What an insufferable woman this is, thought Golov. But he knew the center would pay. They would pay 5 times her asking price for the information. The first discs she already had provided from Pathfinder satellite SSCI briefings had amazed Russian researchers. Additional discs, manuals, and software from future Pathfinder and DoD briefings would be priceless. "Stephanie, you know you have my support always. Don't worry, the center will agree, and gladly." Golov resisted the impulse to pat Boucher's hand across the table. "That's good, Anatoly, because today we were briefed that Pathfinder is close to completing the first stage of bench testing for some of the navigational and targeting circuits. I've insisted on regular progress reports. I'm visiting Pathfinder in Los Angeles once a quarter. This project will be funded for another decade." Boucher blew a stream of smoke straight up. "So if your comrades in Moscow," this last said altogether too loudly, thought Golov, like a threat, "don't want to pay, then okay, we're finished and I'm done." Golov noted once again that it was a measure of Boucher's sublime arrogance, of living in a world devoid of consequences, that she was incapable of contemplating the certainty that the center would never let her quit, that the choice was not hers. Golov tried to imagine the meeting at which Boucher would be told that she would be required to continue spying for Moscow or be exposed. "Of course we're going to continue our collaboration," said Golov soothingly. "Don't even suggest anything else. We will continue safely and securely. You will continue to amaze and astound our people. We will continue to remunerate you for your efforts, and your career will flourish." Golov had long since discarded the temptation to add ideological blandishments. A simple recitation of the facts sufficed. "You pass us secrets, we pay you for them." "I want to continue our discussion from the last time about your security," said Golov. "I know you don't think it's necessary, but I must insist that you listen to me. I'm doing this for you, Stephanie, no one else. It's rather important." Golov sipped his espresso and looked at Boucher over the rim of his cup. Boucher blew cigarette smoke in a huff of fatigue. "You are a well-known personage in Washington," Golov said softly. "In certain circles, I am also recognizable as a senior Russian diplomat. Our continued public meetings are extremely inadvisable. Moscow is worried. I am worried. We have to do better." Golov kept his voice steady, offhand. They had met too frequently. He was stretching his luck. Boucher blew more smoke into the air. "Are we going to have this conversation again?" Boucher said, flicking cigarette ash off the table. "We discussed all this before, and I thought I made myself clear." "Of course we did, Stephanie, but I insist that you reconsider. To start, we have to meet in more private locations, out of the public eye. In addition, the frequency of these personal meetings must also be reduced in favor of impersonal communications." Golov looked into Boucher's narrowing eyes. "Listen, Anatoly, I told you before. I'm not going to root around under some infested tree stump in Great Falls Park at midnight looking for a package from you. I'm not going to accept one of your clunky transmitters that will start smoking in my purse and set off the alarms in the Dirksen building." She held up a hand. Don't tell me about your technology. I know all about spy gear. Your Russian gadgets aren't half as good as ours. Boucher bared her teeth. And I emphatically am not going to begin meeting with some first-tour officer from Abkhazia with manure on his shoes. Before her SVR briefings, the senator